So in that meditation, I hope that you manage to get at least a taste of the experience of what metta feels like. At least some glimpse of what we mean when we're talking about real loving kindness. That kind of love which is spoken about by the great sages, spoken about by Jesus, spoken about by the great prophets and yogis, the great saints of all different religions. It's something which has never been unique to Buddhism. The Buddha never claimed to have invented this practice, never claimed that it was unique to his religion. Quite the contrary, he said that it was practiced very commonly by the sages of old. So it's something which can be done quite independent of any particular religious beliefs, and it really is one of those practices, core ways of being, which is common to all religions. If anything, what distinguishes the Buddhist way of metta, of loving kindness, is not the theory, it's not the idea that it's good to have universal loving kindness, but what's different is that the practice is described very clearly and very practically, step by step. So when we read in, say, the Bible or something like that, and Jesus says, love thine enemy, it's a very beautiful phrase, but we don't find very clear meditation instructions on exactly how to do that. So this is where we are learning how to do those things. We're learning what it really means to love your enemy, yeah? To really love your enemy. Not just to think the thought, oh yes, I wish I'd love my enemy. And in fact, you secretly would wish something quite nasty would happen to them. That's not good enough, yeah? And not even your enemy, but just what about all people? What about people you don't know? People who live in other countries? People who live in completely different societies you've never met, you never will meet? Can we develop loving kindness for all them as well? And also for all the little creatures. People often ask me how I can live in the forest, and I've been staying for many years in the jungles and the forests and so on. And people ask, how can you do that with all the bugs and creepy crawlies? And do that because we have metta and because we're not afraid of other beings. Yeah. So those two things are very closely related, aren't they? If we have ourselves have feeling of aggression and anger, then we'll also tend to have fear when we see other beings. But if we always just have that mind that wishes well, that wants to protect and help other beings, then we won't tend to feel that sense of fear and anger. I don't know if any of you have seen or heard of it, but there's quite a special monastery in Thailand, in Kanchanaburi, where they actually raise tigers from when they're cubs. I don't know if you've seen that. I think it's probably been on the television and so on. And I haven't been there myself, but I know quite a lot of the monks who have been there. And when the tigers are found, maybe the mother's killed or something like that, and the cub is found, and then they're brought to the temple, and they're just raised like pets. And you see the monks just kind of walking around in the monastery with these fully grown tigers. And they're just very playful and friendly, because all they've ever known for their whole life is just loving and affection. And so even such a huge, dangerous animal can be tamed. And this is not something which is just a myth. It's not just something we read about in the Jataka stories or something, where the Buddha will tame the great raging elephant or something like that. It's actually real. It actually happens. So if we want to tame the great raging tigers, then the first thing we have to do, of course, is tame the great raging tiger in here. And that's the hard part. If we can do that, then the four-legged ones is no problem. Yeah? But that's really the problem. So that's why we teach this as a very gradual, step-by-step method. So when we start the metta meditation, just notice each of those stages that we went through in the meditation. First of all, is just getting to a state of like clear awareness, clear comprehension. And so that's a state where the mind is neutral. So what that means is that we don't try to overlay our metta on top of an angry feeling, okay? If we're actually feeling angry and annoyed, don't sit down there and try to do metta. May I be happy, come on, be bloody happy, will you? No, you can't do that. It doesn't work. It makes you even more tense. Yeah? So you have to practice with awareness first, okay? And give that sense of space around things and a sense of distance. And that will usually, unless the feeling of anger is very strong, then that will usually be enough to give you enough space to start the meditation. Sometimes if the anger and annoyance is very strong, someone's really doing something to annoy you, then you might want to try to do something a bit more active to overcome that. For example, you can do like an active reflection at this early stage in the meditation. There are many different kinds of ones you can do. For example, you could reflect that according to the Buddha, all beings in samsara have been our mother and our father, our sons and daughters, our brothers and sisters in past lives. So just reflect like that. This person has also been my mother or my father in the past life. Should I have anger towards them? Or we can reflect on compassion for somebody. If somebody is really evil and nasty and doing all kinds of awful things, we often feel justified to be angry. But we can turn that around. We feel compassion. How does that person feel? Yeah? When they're doing those awful, unkind things, how does it make them feel? And so we put ourselves in their shoes. We feel what it feels like to be them. That's the practice of compassion. Or we can reflect on the ownership of one's karma. We can reflect that, you know, that person is doing these acts through their choice and they will receive the results of that. It's not up to me to punish them. If I choose to respond to that with anger, then I'm just heaping up more bad karma for myself. And in that way, I'm letting them win the battle. They win because I've managed to hurt myself through feeling angry. So we say, I'm not going to buy into that, and we let go. So these are some of the kinds of skillful means we can use, like reflections we can use to overcome anger when it's like a strong feeling of annoyance. Often we don't need to do that if we have good mindfulness, because anger feels unpleasant. Yeah, that's one of the characteristics of it. It's hot, it burns. So if we have the mindfulness to grab it quickly, we know that that's the anger. Oh, okay. And then very often we can let go quite easily. Yeah. But it's only when we don't have the mindfulness, we let it get set in, gets hardened, and gets very strong. And that's where we find it very difficult to let go of. So that's very important to have that mindfulness very quick. So in this first stage of the meditation, you should be able to get to a place where you're reasonably clear and aware, and you know what's going on. We're not talking here about any very profound level of concentration or anything like that, but just a sense of collectedness. So the point here is that we're not rushing into the meditation. Okay, spend a good few minutes, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, to settle into it. Gain a sense of centeredness, a sense of awareness, and at least to be able to slow down the rushing thoughts, even if you can't stop them completely. If you can stop completely, is good. If you can't, at least to slow them down, at least to notice the gaps. Notice that you're not thinking all the time, that there is some stillness there, and to get at least that degree of settledness. And then when you can do that, then you're ready to start the metta meditation. So the first stage, metta for oneself, very, very important. We can't overstress how important it is to develop metta for oneself. This is the foundation for all the practice. Yes, it's true that metta for oneself is incomplete. Okay? If it's just for oneself, then that's not a complete metta practice. But we're not talking about the complete practice here. We're talking about the foundations. And so we have to be a bit honest. Okay? We have to think, well, who do we really think about the most in our daily lives? Well, number one, isn't it? Yeah, who are most of our thoughts concerned? Who are most of our emotions concerned with? Actually, it's this person here. Yeah, if we have to be honest, maybe 90%, 95%, 99%, maybe. Get up in the morning, we look in the mirror. Whose face do we see? We see our face. Whose teeth do we brush after the meal? Well, we brush our teeth. Whose hands do we wash when they get dirty? We wash our hands. And so our thoughts, our concerns are, simply as a matter of fact, largely concerned with ourselves and only secondarily concerned with others. This is our normal emotional state of being. So given this we should make sure we really lay that foundation. If we can't develop metta for ourselves, then how can we develop metta for somebody else? So the characteristic of metta here is that metta is a love, a care, a concern, a well-wishing that is not concerned with getting anything. It's only concerned with giving. Okay, and this is how you know the difference between true loving kindness, a very pure loving kindness, and that worldly love and worldly attachment. Worldly attachment always wants to get something. And so very often you find that when a person says that they love somebody else, when you look at that more closely, what you find is what they actually love is the feeling that that person gives us. I love you because you make me feel good. I love you because what you can give me or what I can get out of you. And so this is this worldly kind of attachment. Normally in our relationships with people, it's always mixed up. There's always some wholesome intentions emotions there, a genuine sense of caring and concern, and as well there's this sense of attachment as well. So our normal relationships with people, whether it be with our sexual partners or with our families or whatever, it usually has this kind of mixed emotional state. So what we want to do in metta is just develop this very pure loving kindness, starting with oneself. Now, do this a lot. Do it every day. Do it for a long time. You can spend many months or many years even just developing metta for oneself before going on to doing it for the other stages. Don't be in a hurry. The more you hurry, the slower your progress will be. The longer you stay with developing metta for oneself, the deeper that practice will go and the more you will appreciate it. And the more you realize, actually, you can stay there and keep getting deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper. And your mind can become very, very powerful, very, very bright and very, very pure, even just on that first stage of metta for oneself. So don't be in a hurry, okay? If you can get that foundational practice done very well, then you'll be able to do the later stages no problem. Okay? It's that first one that's really the key. So what we usually say is we develop it up to the stage of having like a preliminary nimitta. Okay, so this word nimitta is a technical term in Buddhist meditation, and what a nimitta is literally means a sign. Okay, so when we say something's a nimitta, what it means is it's a sign that our mind is telling us that we've reached a certain level of concentration or a certain level of purity of mind. Okay, that's really what it is. Now that sign, when people talk about nimittas, usually appears as something like a bright light. Okay, so people will often talk about a nimitta as like a light. Sometimes it'll be a sense of radiance, sometimes a specific light, or whatever. In metta meditation, the nimitta doesn't tend to be in the form of a light so much, although it can be. But usually what we're talking about in metta is the feeling of metta as the nimitta, okay? So that means the mind is absorbed in that feeling. So remember when we're doing the guided meditation, I talked about a number of different aspects in turn. One, first one, the words of metta. Now anyone can do that. Anyone can have a thought of metta. Anybody can sit down and go, may I be happy. So this is a wholesome thought, okay? This is in the Noble Eightfold Path, Sammasankappa, right aspiration or right thought of the Noble Eightfold Path. And that's very simple and that's already very beneficial, so we can all do that much. Now along with that thought, the second thing that goes along with that is like with that, with those words, is the aspiration, the wish, okay? And that's something which that thought is generating. It's like you're doing it, okay? So at this stage in the meditation, it's a bit artificial, okay? It's almost like we're pretending to have metta, yeah? It's almost like you're putting on a performance to yourself. That's okay. Don't worry about it. Of course, that's not true metta yet, but it's the way to do it. It's like you can think if you're an actor on a stage, yeah? Maybe if you're an actor, if you're playing somebody who's very angry, and you know, you're having to pretend to be angry, then obviously that would tend to make you angry, wouldn't it? Just because you're pretending. They have this thing they call these days, they call the laughing yoga. I don't know if you've heard about that, as they do in some places. They started in India and they're spread in different places, but that's, you get a group of people get together and just kind of make funny faces at each other and do silly things and act like clowns and just make each other laugh. And the idea is that if you can pretend that you're happy, if you can pretend that you're laughing, that it actually makes you happy. Yeah? And it's quite very skillful means, actually. I highly recommend it. If you want to maybe form a laughing yoga group, can meet at Tun Sing Temple. Come together and make each other laugh by doing silly things. And then once you've done that, once you've laughed for half an hour, then go and sit meditation for half an hour. And I'm sure you'll have much better meditation because you've made yourself happy like that. Yeah? I think it's a very, very skillful technique. So, we pretend to have metta for ourselves and we pretend to be happy. That's okay. Yeah? Don't tell yourself, oh, I can't be happy, I'm a stressed out person, I'm tense, I'm worried, all that kind of stuff. Don't tell yourself that. You believe it. Yeah? Forget all that. Tell yourself, I'm a happy person. Yeah? I'm a really jolly person. I'm a person that everybody likes and full of good humour and goodwill. And if you say those things, then you believe it. So as you're saying those words, as you have the words of metta, you have the intention of metta, then you also have the feeling of metta. And it's that feeling which is the key. And it's that feeling which is going to take your mind into deep states of concentration. Okay? So this is really the metta. Everything else is just the tools. Okay? Everything else is around the meditation. But it's that feeling which is the result of those tools, and I described it in the guided meditation as this feeling, a soft feeling, very gentle, like a petal of a flower, very radiant, like a soft little glow. So when you can notice that, a very, very delicate, then just stay with that. Just gently place your mind on that feeling, but very, very softly, like it's a little bird or a little animal. And if it's something like a little animal, then it'll come to you if you're very, very soft and quiet. But if you're very loud and rough, then it'll go away. When I was eating lunch today, the house I was eating, the fellow had got a couple of chipmunks. And they're very, very cute. They're about this little big. One of them came up to me when I was eating lunch, and I got a little piece of bread and held it out, and it was a bit nervous at first, and then I just got to hold it out a bit more, and then gradually comes up and has a little nibble on the bread, and then it gets a little bit more confidence, and then puts his paws out and takes it and then starts nibbling. Very, very cute. So this is how the mind is as well. If I'd been very rough and said, hey chipmunk, come here, and of course he runs a million miles away. So this is what we have to do. We have to make the mind feel comfortable. You know, like, I don't know if you have in your house, you have your comfortable chair. You know, a place where you go and you sit. And, you know, you've been sitting in that chair for many years, and it's adjusted itself to all your lumpy bits, okay? It fits your curves and exactly the right way. And when you sit there, you don't want to get up. You're very comfortable and relaxed. This is how we want to make the mind, that place where it's very, very soft and comfortable and relaxed. And then it will just stay there. And so you just stay with that feeling. At first you might not notice it. At first you might think the feeling isn't there. But it is there. Okay? Sometimes it's just a trick of perception. The feeling's really there, but we don't notice it because we don't know how to look. We're not quite sure what we're looking for. So this is something which, this is really the key which you have to learn for yourself. It's not something which I can teach you or do for you. You have to trust that if you have those wholesome intentions you're bringing into the meditation, that feeling will be there, okay? It's just natural. It's not something which is special or unique to any individual. That feeling is natural. We all know what it feels like. Sometimes if you can't feel it in the meditation, then maybe you need to think of something, bring up a memory that will trigger that feeling so you can then recognize it. For example, you might bring up a memory of when your cat had kittens, and you just, that first time you saw the little kittens there, and the first time you held them in your arms. Or maybe if you're a mother, the first time you had your baby, and the first time you held the baby in your arms just after it was born. Just remember that feeling of the total love, unconditional love that you had at that time. So whatever that feeling may be, whatever that memory may be, just bring that memory to mind and notice what that feeling is. Once you gain familiarity with the feeling, then you can do it automatically. You can do it just naturally. So we can try to do this feeling of metta, as I said before, we make it stable, okay, so it lasts for a long time, even. We're not after a big peak of experience like that. We're not something that's fluctuating, but we want something that's even and steady, very gentle, and something that can last for a reasonable amount of time. When we feel fairly confident with that feeling, we can gradually spread it through the body. So you're trying to absorb and soak the feeling through your whole body. And this is a kind of imagery which the Buddha used very often when he was talking about meditation. He would describe the meditator like a lotus blossom which is growing in a pond of water. But the flower was blooming underneath the surface of the water, so that the cool water was pervading all the way through the lotus. And it's that kind of suffusing and pervading imagery which we're trying to reflect in our meditation here, so the happiness, the bliss and the rapture is spreading through the whole body. So your body becomes very light, it feels very, very joyful. And so if you can do that, obviously you're not going to be bored with your meditation. You're not going to be thinking, oh, when's this going to be over? You're not going to be opening your eyes and having a peep at the clock to see if you've managed to endure for long enough. If you can do this, you'll just feel like you just want to keep on doing it for longer and longer. No need to force it, but just to make your mind bring that happiness up and sustain it. So if you can keep it sustained through your whole body, for maybe, I don't know, 20 minutes or half an hour or so, then that's very good. And so this is maybe what we call the stage of the preliminary nimitta. You almost get a feeling like, with this nimitta, you almost get a feeling like things are falling into place, like the mind is becoming collected, that previously you were struggling to be with the meditation object. Most of the time you were thinking about this and that, and you weren't with the meditation, and only occasionally were you with it. But now when the nimitta comes together like this, you have a feeling like most of the time you are with the meditation, you are doing it properly, and only occasionally are you going outside. So this is what we call the stage of the nimitta. Again, this is not a very deep level of concentration. You can still hear things, you can still feel your body, the mind can still think about this and that, but mostly you're with the meditation. So then we can move to the second stage, metta for the loved one. Now here, when you choose your loved person, don't choose somebody who's one of your sexual partners or someone who you're going to feel sexually attracted to, okay? So men don't choose the women don't choose the men. If you're gay, you have to make suitable adjustments, okay? I don't need to go into all the details, all right? And so this is the reason we do this, of course, is because we want to avoid getting this mixture that I was talking about before, where you have the mixture of the wholesome emotions of caring and also the unwholesome emotions of lust and wanting to get. So just choose somebody who one feels a very pure sense of love for, maybe one's parents or grandparents, a respected teacher or something like that, one's best friend, someone that's easy to develop metta for. Usually the second stage is not such a problem. If you can develop the first stage quite well for 20 to 30 minutes, with the mind full through the body for 20 to 30 minutes, then you can do the second stage maybe for 10 minutes or so, should be enough. Doesn't have to be very long because it's quite an easy stage. Then the next stage is the third stage, and that third stage is much more interesting, metta for the neutral person. Of course, the problem with the neutral person is that they're neutral. Yeah? You're not interested in them one way or the other, so you tend to find that the mind tends to drift a little bit. you're not so concerned with them. It's not somebody who you think about normally. In fact, you might find it's difficult to think of a neutral person. It tends to be that you think, oh, who's neutral? You can't think of one. And so that's a sign of like your lack of concern for people. That's what we tend to go through our life, encountering people, meeting people all the time, and we don't really care about them. You know, maybe someone, we come to the Buddhist group, I see this gentleman at the end sitting here, and maybe I don't care about him. He's just sitting there, and he's just another bloke. Yeah, maybe he's going to walk out and get run over by a car after here. Now, this isn't a curse or anything. I'm just giving an example, and we wouldn't get upset about that as if we would for somebody that we're very close to. So this is how, this is like an emotional poverty in our minds, that we don't care for strangers the same as we do for ordinary people. This is why we are capable of doing things like going to war, because we can see someone dying in our own country and we don't like that, we get upset, but we're quite happy to go to somebody else's country and kill people there because we're not close to them. That's why, like, say, you know, this recent war in Iraq, and the Americans don't like it when their own people in America get killed, and so they'll send their soldiers to kill even thousands, tens of thousands of people in another country. But that's not so painful for them. They seem to be able to deal with that okay, and that's because of this lack of emotional richness in our lives. Sometimes people worry, they think that when they come to Buddhism and Buddhism starts talking about non-attachment and letting go of desires, they think that they're not going to love their family anymore. They think that they're going to become like a, I don't know, like a robot or something like that. Or you think that enlightened people are like a cyborg or something. You kind of don't have any feelings anymore. But of course that's not true. You just don't have the bad feelings. You don't have the feelings that lead to suffering. In fact, what you're doing is you're not getting rid of that love, but what you're doing is you're stopping yourself from constricting your love. You're stopping yourself from restricting it to just you and your circle of intimates and family and friends. But you're taking that and expanding it further and further and further out. So this is really what we're doing. And in metta meditation, we're doing this in a very conscious way, very deliberately. So now we're developing metta for the neutral person. Be careful when you're doing this. Don't allow the mind to drop into a neutral state of mind, an equanimous state of mind. Remember, metta always has pleasant feeling. Okay? So when you're doing your metta meditation, you should always have the sense of pleasure and joy with it. Never with a sense of just equanimity, flat. Okay, so if you're doing the meditation, especially this third stage, very often happens you might lose mindfulness a bit, and then the joy of the metta will fall away and you'll fall into like a flat equanimity. And that actually feels quite pleasant, okay? But you feel very peaceful, okay? You think, oh, I'm being very tranquil here, and it's good. And that's a subtle form of mara, okay? So when you do that, you get into such a state, you know mara has grabbed hold of me, okay? Without me knowing it. Because your meditation is a meditation on happiness, not the meditation on equanimity. Okay, so this is a subtle form of delusion. If you feel that that's happened in your metta, then come back to the first stage and then restart the meditation. Bring up the sense of joy and happiness, build that up. When you feel that's strong enough, come up to the third stage. Now, that's really like a general rule in this practice. Each stage is a little bit more difficult. Each one will take a little bit more mind power, a little bit more mindfulness, a little bit more clarity of mind. So if you're not ready for that higher stage, you'll find that it won't work so well. Okay? So this is how you use to test your practice. If you can do metta for the first person, okay, that's great. Try going to the second one. Does that work or not? If you find that the metta is dropping back and weakening, then come back to the first stage, redevelop it there, make it strong, make it clear, and then when you feel you're ready, you can go back again. As you do this with time and experience, then you'll know what is what. You'll know when you're ready to go to the higher stages and how strong the mind is. So this is how you're learning wisdom. You're learning the ways of the mind through the practice. So if you can master that third stage, you're doing very well. And can move on to the fourth stage. And this, of course, is where the the real test is at hand. And if one can develop metta for the fourth person, then for the disliked person, then there's nobody in the whole world who you can't have metta for. So at this stage you'll need to have a lot of strength of mind. You'll need to have that strength that can hold the mind steady and yet very, very gently. You can't have any tension or forcing. Yeah, that will destroy it completely. But it has to have that like 100% attention. And you'll notice at this stage that your mind becomes very alert. Your mindfulness becomes very strong. Because you've only got like one enemy now to deal with, okay? You'll start to become concentrated. You'll start to notice a deeper level of one-pointedness of mind. The sensation of the body will start to drop away. You won't be so aware of the feelings in your body and sounds and things like that. You still are aware of them, but not so much. You're starting to go into the mind, starting to go into one-pointedness. Just stay with that as long as you can. As long as you're not forcing it, okay? As long as you're not pushing and straining, but just stay with that, deepen that, deepen that, deepen that. You'd need to stay with that fourth stage for maybe an hour or more before you can really complete that. So don't be in a rush with this, just stay there, stay there, stay there. And as you continue on with that fourth stage, mind is going deeper and deeper, then the nimitta will start to get much more powerful and will start to move towards what we call the technical term is the paribhaga nimitta, or perhaps we could just say it's like the real nimitta, okay? And this real nimitta or deep nimitta will arise. Most meditators, if they're practicing, maybe might have to sit for say 3 hours at a sitting. So if you sort of have to work up until you can sit for usually at least 2 or 3 hours before you can start to experience these levels of concentration. I don't say that in order to intimidate you, but I do say it because a lot of times people, I think in the Buddhist world, and especially when we start talking about meditation and levels of concentration, there's a lot of problems with overestimation and all these kinds of things. And of course we have to talk about them. We have to talk about levels and stages of concentration because we have to show people actually what the mind is like and where to go, where's the map. People actually realize these things, okay? People actually get there. They're not just myths. They're not just something that's read about in the old books, but they're something people do actually experience, and we have to talk about them so that they know what to do. But don't start, you know, thinking, oh, I've got this jhana or that jhana or this nimitta or that nimitta. Don't worry about those things, but just learn to recognize the stages. In Thailand, in the forest tradition, they tend to use that standard of like the length of time that you sit in order to be able to get in a certain level of concentration. And I've heard a number of different teachers who are teaching samadhi mention a period of time of about 3 hours as being like how long it normally takes for a meditator to develop the mind to a level of concentration where they can go into jhana. So that's like a rough ballpark figure. Of course, some people may be much quicker, some people may be much longer. But as a rough figure, most meditators will probably take something like around 3 hours developing the preliminary meditation before they will go into jhana. So here we're talking about the arising of the nimitta. The nimitta isn't jhana yet, but it's not far away. It's what we call upachara samadhi, which is like the access concentration, the neighborhood concentration. Now, when that nimitta arises, it will be the most profound experience of your whole life. It will be this incredibly powerful, overwhelmingly powerful, awe-inspiring feeling and radiance of loving-kindness. It's almost like all of the negative thoughts and emotions become pushed out of your mind. They just simply can't coexist in there with this incredible force. And so this is when you experience that, then you'll know why, if you're a Christian meditator, you would see that and you would say, this is God. You would come out of the meditation and you would say, I've seen the face of God. Yeah? Or you would say, Jesus came to see me in the meditation. This is how powerful that experience is. You can really believe that this is the creative force that lies behind the whole universe. And of course, you're quite right. It is the creative force that lies behind the whole universe. It is the mind. And now you're actually seeing the mind, the radiant mind that the Buddha spoke about, the mind that's freed from the five hindrances. You're starting to get a glimpse of that. At the stage of the fourth person, the stage of Upachara Samadhi, you can still experience sounds and touches with the body a little bit. For example, maybe if you're sitting meditating and then suddenly there's a noise nearby, someone slams the door or something, that might jolt you out of the meditation. Or sometimes maybe if you have a pain in your body or something, then you can still feel that. But generally speaking, you'll be pretty much in that world of the mind. So once you've done that, then move to the fifth stage, which then would be the metta for all people. Okay? And then we expand the metta just like we did in the guided meditation. Okay? So remember how at the end of it we did all people in this room and we allow the metta to move out from the body. So when we do this, that was just like a run through, okay? So that was like a trial run, okay? We hadn't been sitting long enough to really develop that very strong nimitta. But when you have got that strong nimitta and you can do that, you can really feel what that means. Finally, you can feel what the Buddha was talking about when he said one develops universal loving kindness. One is radiating metta. You can actually feel that. You feel the mind moving out of the body and radiating up to the skies, all over the earth, gently moving the mind out. May all people be happy. You can still just think the thought at this stage. The mind is still not completely firm and concentrated. So you can just think to yourself, may all people be happy. May all people be happy. And just let that mind expand until it covers the whole world. And then once you can do that, then you just let go. Okay, there's nothing more you can do. You've done all the preliminary work, all the preparations. You just let go. And from then on, just let the mind take care of itself. From then on, don't try to control. Don't try to go forward. Don't try to go back. Don't try to stay still. You just let go and trust the mind to know where its own nature will lie. Okay, so I've now talked for quite a while and I've taken you up to a quite advanced stage in metta practice. Okay, a stage which many of you might think is beyond you. Many of you won't have experienced these kinds of things, but all of you can. And I'm sure that all of you will. I personally have such faith in the Buddha's path that I believe that anybody here who's really practicing with diligence can actually realize these things. It's just the nature of the mind. It's nothing special. The Buddha himself had just the same kind of mind that you and I had. He had five senses. He saw sights. He heard sounds. He had smells, tastes, and touches. And in his mind he had thoughts and feelings and so on, just as you and I did. And when he was developing meditation, when he was a bodhisattva, before he was enlightened, he had all the same problems that you and I have in our meditation. And if you read the accounts of the Buddha's life before he's enlightened, it's quite interesting. If you read the later accounts, and they always tend to glorify how the bodhisattva was almost completely enlightened even before he sat under the tree in Bodh Gaya. But the early account tends to emphasize the opposite. It tends to emphasize the struggles and difficulties that the Buddha had. And very often the monks would go to see the Buddha and he would say, how's your meditation going? And they say, well, not very well, Bhante. You know, we were practicing for a while and got some nimittas and then had sloth and torpor arose. And the Buddha said, yeah, I know how it feels. You know, I had the same problem when I was meditating too. Or he had a fear living in the forest. Or he would suffer from doubts. Or he would suffer from anger. All these kinds of problems which he had. He would suffer from a wandering mind, thinking about this and that. All these kinds of things which he encountered, which are just the same as you and I encounter in our meditation. And of course, the Buddha persevered, and that's really the crucial difference. He had that energy, that persistence to be able to keep going, to overcome any obstacles. And that's the key, and that's what will lead us to Nibbana. And so I'd really like to encourage you all to take up this practice of meditation, whether you end up doing metta meditation, as I've been talking about this evening, or whether you do some other meditation. Whatever you do, then take it up with diligence, take it up with trust. All of the meditations that you'll hear the meditation teachers teaching are all of them worthwhile. They're all taught from people's experience and practice, and they will all lead to good benefits. So you don't need to doubt about these. You don't need to worry, should I do this practice or that practice, or which one's right and which one's wrong and all those things. But whatever you try it, you see for yourself, and whatever you feel an attraction to, an affinity for, then take that practice up and really go for it. Give it 100% and really see what the fruits of the practice that the Buddha was talking about. So this is my little talk this evening on developing metta meditation, loving kindness, and specifically focused on developing metta for gaining concentration of mind and samadhi. And so I've taught a practice which I've done for many years, and which I know a lot of other people have benefited from, and which I can wholeheartedly recommend to you all. So if anybody has any comments or questions about the talk this evening or about anything else, then I'd be most interested to hear.